Security and honesty is being crowded by these grown thoughts. Reality is catching it's kind of, you know, it's interesting you brought this, you know, this the kid, the song up, because over the past week I've been a little, well, I talked about Grandmaster Flash and whatnot a couple weeks ago, and I'm not saying I've become a hip hop fanboy so much, but I have been listening to a little bit more, you know, of some of the classic hip, not just classic rap, you know, but actually, you know, like 90s hip hop type stuff, just a little bit, but there's actually an avenue, you know, I find it enjoyable, you know, more than I ever had before.
Of course, I mean, look, there was the initial stuff, the Grandmaster Flash and all that stuff, where, like, you know, drum machine, and they do simple stuff. But come on, this evolved. It's been 20 years plus since then.
Right.
This has evolved into people who are doing awful stuff and people who are doing amazing stuff with this.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, I mean, Kanye West is a dickhole, but I know other guys who are dickholes who are also great artists. An example, a great example to me, is Dan Harmon.
I knew you were going there.
Yeah.
He is a dickhole.
He's a dickhole, but he's a great artist. You know, so there are people who are just, you know, pieces of shit in terms of who they are, but they're also fantastic at what they do. And Kanye West is one of those people. And I think he makes some great music. And you know, I think you'll find that some of his stuff, if you were to listen to some of his stuff, not everything.
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it. Not everybody can be the Pixies and have no bad songs. But... but... And the honest truth is that I kind of sort of mean that. I don't. They've made one or two bad songs, but nothing in their released stuff has been a song that you can say, "Oh, that's just a shitty song." In their four releases, every song they made was at least on some level decent. Now there've been, you know, B sides and things like that. And
I'd have to go through. I mean, I generally enjoy the Pixies. I personally.
They only made four albums. I mean, well, you know, the Beatles made like 18. Right. So
I don't think... I don't find all the Pixies songs distinctive.
Well, I tell you...
There's a lot of similar... I mean, it's like Pavement, right? A lot of similar sounding type stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what the secret is to the Pixies. And it's not Frank Black and it's not Kim Deal. The secret is Joey Santiago, the guy who plays the guitar. He makes the songs what they are. With his guitar and his guitar work and his sort of lines of main guitar through there. He unifies the sound. And so if you listen for that, I think that's what makes everything good. So Joey Santiago is the guy that makes the Pixies, as much as Frank Black gets credit for writing.
So he's the John Bonham of the Pixies. Or the John Paul Jones of the Pixies, I mean.
John Paul Jones?
John Paul Jones is the bassist of Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, I guess so, then. If the bass line are what makes Led Zeppelin songs unified, then yes, because really what makes the Pixies songs unified is Joey Santiago's guitar work.
Right. Yeah, you turned me on to the Pixies. I really never heard of them before you, and I've listened to their stuff. I enjoy it. I'd have to listen to them a little bit more, but they have a very stink sound.
Yes.
It reminds me a lot of Pavement and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you know, I'm not a huge music guy. I'm just a guy who, you know, I like what I like. I don't know necessarily why. I'm less... in tune with that than I am like my taste buds or even you know, science things. I understand science way more than I understand music, even though when you think about it, they all kind of devolve into the same sort of mathematics. But the Pixies were one of the first things that's sort of interesting, but I'm still not a music guy. I'm still not a guy who listens to music a lot. And I don't think I ever will be. But I appreciate certain things. Now that... Again, Jeff is a big Led Zeppelin fan. I actually enjoy a good deal of what Led Zeppelin does. I think I've grown enough to really understand their stuff and get a good idea. I actually have grown to understand a lot of what the Beatles did and not hate them nearly as much as I used to.
I thought like I've probably talked about this before on the show, but it has been a few years, if not like 5 years since I mentioned it. Growing up, my mom was born in like 48, 9, you know, baby boomer.
Yeah.
And I heard Beatles growing up, but it was always love, love me do.
Right, right. It's exactly what I heard. Yeah, yeah.
And I want to hold your hand.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And then, like, you know, when I was in Boy Scouts, there was a couple guys a little bit older than me, a couple years ahead of me. And, you know, they were Beatles fans, but it was Sergeant Pepper. Uh-huh. It was the White Album.
Yeah. While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Completely.
That kind of stuff. Yeah.
Well, I mean, even better than While My Guitar Gently Weeps, you know, it was Paperback Writer and, you know, it just like...
Paperback Writer isn't that great, but Revolver, you know, those good albums where it's like, you know, okay, they're trying something different. They're not doing this cheesy kind of mix between doo-wop and just slightly more sophisticated stuff. Yeah. It was...
I mean, the Beatles have some fantastic stuff. It just took... I didn't realize it existed. Yeah. And, like, I don't even think my mom... who saw the Beatles the first time in Pittsburgh, you know, with the Screaming Girls and the Love, Love Me Do era. I'm not sure my mom knew or even knows now, you know, what the Beatles actually did that was appreciable, you know.
I've explained before on the show how I've, you know, I grew up listening to the Beatles, but their doo-wop / stuff, their old stuff, that's all I listened to, so I didn't like the Beatles. I didn't like the Beatles for a long time, but now I can appreciate them because I see what they've done. But I'm still more... That was me. Mm-hmm. I'm still more along the lines of... It's... I'm still more... If you were to call me out on a band that I like from the era, I'm still more of a Stones guy. I still think, you know, Paint It Black and all the other stuff.
I like Paint It Black, but Stones in general? Maybe... So I have a strained relationship with blues.
Okay.
I know I should like blues, but I don't. You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the Stone stuff, other than Painted Black, is so blues inspired that
there's a lot of blues progression in their stuff.
I don't love Stones. I like the Beatles. Once I discovered the Beatles catalog, you know, I like a lot of their 70s stuff, you know, their late 60s, early 70s stuff a lot better.
Well, you know, but there's stuff like, you know, Brown Sugar, which is sort of a popular song.
Yeah, no. Like, Painted Black's probably my favorite Stone song. I'm trying to think what else I like. Wild Horses is okay. More ballady.
Yeah.
No, I like that one.
I mean, we're in a different generation, so we have different touchstones. And, you know, while we can appreciate what came before, we have different touchstones. I mean, you know, I'm thinking, you know, weirdly, one of my touchstones is Information Society. Remember them? I want to know what you're thinking.
Okay,
Tell me what's on your mind.
Yeah, yeah, so listen to that when it comes on. That's like MTV, like, callback, you know?
Yeah, and Tears for Fears. You know, everybody wants to rule.
Some Depeche Mode.
Sure. Duran. You know, I have...
So, like, these ones you're just talking about, Depeche Mode, Duran, Tears for Fears. Again, some of the songs hit it for me, but, like, that's early emo.
Like, the Pixies, all of... I can listen to one of their albums nonstop, and it's very few bands that I can do that with, where I can just listen to an album from beginning to end and just really just not skip a song and not be like, oh, this song sucks. Okay. But because that's rare, and that's why I think the Pixies are good, because they made 4 albums, and I don't think there's a skippable song on all of them, although other people may argue. But I really don't think that they had a bad song on any of their albums, any of their major albums. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily say they never made a bad song. They have. There are Makes songs sense. They made sure. in their off stuff, and they're actually making a new album now. Who knows what they're going to make? But during their prime, it was just good, great, etc.
Right.
So,
Have you listened to any, like, what's your, like, favorite, what you consider new artist? Anything?
I don't know if I can call one, because there's, I haven't been paying that as much attention. Mm-hmm. You know me, I'm not a huge music guy. So
I'm just wondering what you found. Like, because mine's going to, like, for a music geek, mine's going to sound very pedestrian, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, the favorite, what I would consider new band, even though it's not so, even I realize it's not so new anymore, is Mumford & Sons.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cliche, and, you know, all the hipsters like it, but just the tonality of their music and whatnot does it for me. I really like Mumford & Sons.
Yeah, I mean, I think, okay, I know a song or two from Modest Mouse, and I know a song or two from
I like Modest Mouse, yeah. But they're one where, like, I like some of their sounds, but I don't like all of their sounds.
Yeah.
Where Mumford & Sons, I seem to like all of their sounds.
Well, also, it's like, I mean, you look at the old Radiohead stuff, and they were all great, and then you look at the newer albums, you're like...
Mm-hmm. Radiohead was great?
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
The first couple albums were awesome. The first couple albums were, like, extensions of Pixies albums, but then they just got different.
This is where we disagree.
All right.
I don't like Radiohead.
All right. You're loud.
I know.
I can't.
We're just having fun here, right? In the post shows.
So. No, we're arguing. I need to take a pause if you don't mind.
All right. All right. So we just came back from a little double pee break. So if it's not cohesive, that's why.
We're talking about music, but we can go on another.
No, actually, I have one more thing I want to say. Yeah. I'm looking. I want someone to find me a band I will like that. Find me the next, for me, when I say the next, I don't mean the next platinum or anything, but the next for me, I want you to find me the next Mumford & Sons, Ben Folds, Counting Crows, Social Distortion, and if you tell me the National, I'm going to punch you in the ear. So, there you go.
Ben Folds, Counting Crows, Social Distortion.
Folds,
I really dislike. Counting Crows, I despise.
Okay.
Social Distortion, don't really know much about, so...
Right.
Counting Crows, God. Are you kidding me? I forget where it was, but I heard a Counting Crows song. It was just like whining.
The other day.
Mr. Jones.
No, the whining one is Perfect Blue Buildings. That's the whiny, shitty one.
Okay, whatever you say, Jeff.
Throwing it out there.
Community is coming back. They have a date.
Nice,
yeah. January 2nd. They already canceled a show, and that means the Community has a spot. So January 2nd, the day after New Year's.
Already canceled a show.
Yeah, it's NBC, right? So Community is coming back January 2nd, possibly
that
last season. Dan Harmon's back. It'll be good again.
So they're like, hey, Dan, we'll put your shit on the air if we cancel one of these pilots.
Well, I mean, it was always known that it was going to be a mid-season thing, because they only had 13 episodes. Yeah. Show, but they might get two more.
Do you know what show it replaced?
Welcome to the Family.
Okay, is that the one with no?
It's not the Michael J. Fox one. If that's what you're thinking.
I thought it was the one with the guy from Will and Grace. The other,
no, that's Sean Saves the World.
Sean Saves the World. Okay,
don't expect that one to last either. Okay, here comes the cold. Finally, we're getting some cold.
Uh-huh.
It's about 42 degrees outside. It has been a long time coming, because it's been in the 60s and 70s. I had to keep my air conditioner on in my bedroom, mm-hmm. because I'm on the second floor and heat rises. But finally, don't have to worry about that anymore. That's good. Before we go into the last topic that I have, do you have any topics?
I don't have a prepared list, no.
Okay.
I don't have a prepared statement at this time.
I wanted to talk a little bit about something that I've, you know, science-wise, that I've been kind of skirting past, but mostly because I've been concentrating on particle physics. I've been concentrating on things like the Higgs, where there's so much more I could talk about with the Higgs, like in terms of why the Higgs with its Mexican hat potential has... clearly another route for it
racist,
to go.
You racist.
Clearly has another route, but why those other directions, why those other degrees of freedom were eaten up by gauge theories? But that's
Yes, you've bored us thoroughly with the Higgs, so let's go.
I wanted to talk slightly about something on a whole different angle, which is general relativity, or special relativity, really, in this case, and the idea of hyperbolic rotation. Because this is kind of important to understanding general relativity, which is that in general relativity, the concept of motion and rotation are unified, which is really weird for us to try to understand, because for us, we think of a three-dimensional thing, and we think of rotation as being sort of changing your angle in a three-dimensional phase space, whereas in a four-dimensional phase space, rotation and motion itself are unified. So the idea is that your sine, your cosine, and tangent, which are basically, you know, they're kind of triangles on a unit circle, right? I mean, an angle just measures the arc length of a unit circle.
Right. It's been so long since I've done trig that I don't know off top what.
Okay.
Well, a sine, cosine. All right. Well, is on the circle.
I mean, a sine is.
I know what a sine wave looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
But how's that? How does that? So I don't recall how that relates to the radii of a circle type thing.
Right. I mean, it would take more time for me to explain it. Really. So, but in general relativity,
and if I don't
special relativity.
The details, a lot of listeners aren't
clear. Yeah, you use sine H, cosine H, and tan H, which are, instead of using standard unit hyperbola, because you're dealing with four dimensions. And so you have a hyperbola that's your standard unit. And in those, you have acceleration treated like a rotation through a hyperbolic angle. So in that sense, what you're doing. Jeff is like,
Well, no, I can actually almost picture what you said.
Yeah. So
rotation, acceleration is treated as rotational. Whatever you just said.
Yeah.
I know what a hyperbolic angle is. Yeah. I can imagine rotating on that vector. So I get it. Kind of. I can actually picture that.
And so what you get is that rotation and motion are the same thing. It's just you're treating it as slightly differently with a slightly different way of computing the outcome. And that's why you have these weird time and spatial things, because you're treating it – you're altogether treating everything in a different way. And when it comes down to it, just – you know, the whole deal with the temporal paradox with the, for example.
You need to bring this home. You lost me about two sentences ago.
Okay.
And now you're going into the paradoxes, and I don't know where you're going. I don't know where you came from.
Well, I mean, what I'm trying to extend is that you can't, like, people ask why you can't exceed the speed of light, and it's because the hyperbola has an asymptote at C. So you can't go faster than that. You have that right triangle with an asymptote at C.
Okay. A hyperbolic curve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an escape curve, and it approaches a straight line, but it never reaches a straight line. Yeah. So you can't get beyond a straight line, is what you're saying, right? So
if you're going out very far, it may seem to you that time may be different than here or there. But especially when you turn around, that's when all the dynamics kick in, because you're now, what you call now sort of rotates with you when you stop. It's a rotation. And a good analogy is kind of like if you're driving north in a car at the same latitude as, like, I don't know, something really low in California, San Diego, and then and LA is ahead of you, and Miami is behind you in terms of where they are, right? You're driving north in Texas at the
you
same
said
latitude.
You're driving north in Southern California.
No, you're driving north in Texas, but the same latitude as San Diego.
Uh-huh.
But you're driving to LA.
Oh, driving.
Yeah.
You're driving past the latitude of LA.
Right.
You're not driving to LA.
Well, you're driving. Well, ahead,
you're driving
LA
north.
Is ahead of you. LA is ahead of you,
you're
and Miami
using, no, you're
is
using,
behind
you're
you.
Using very poor descriptors, because you were driving north.
Yeah.
So when you say
from the latitude of San
Diego, the latitude of LA, the latitude of Florida, Miami,
from the latitude of San Diego, which is lower than LA. Okay, yes. so you're driving north, so LA would be ahead of you.
It's southern.
Southern. Well, but I'm saying is you can look at it as a direction. You're driving north.
Right. So, but you're extracting a point into a plane.
Well, right? that's the whole point. That you know, general relativity turns a plane into a hyperbolic plane. So so you have this. So this is ahead of you, Miami's bad, but if then you turn right and head towards South Carolina, you know, then LA is behind you, and now Miami is ahead of you. And that is the way the time works when you're turning in this weird way.
Okay, so you kind of, you finally got to some place where, so what I pictured, finally, way too long to get there.
Sorry.
Come better analogies, man. It's that whole, you're following the hyperbolic curve, something that is, quote-unquote, okay, so say it is to your left behind you. As you accelerate, it's going to become to your left in front of you because you're accelerating along this hyperbolic curve.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and frankly, it's not that hard math to understand. But it's such an amazing amount. I mean, I really think that, you know, if anyone's confused by what I'm saying, do a course in special relativity. Because no, because I'm being totally clear here. It's not difficult math, but it's incredible how fundamental and how amazing it is how the consequences are. Like I, you know, the consequences of general relativity, that's a huge amount of ridiculous math. The stuff that goes on in particle physics, you have to start to get into gauge theory, and that's a ridiculous amount of math. But special relativity does not require a huge amount of math, and it has incredible consequences just studying it. So if you really want to get an idea of what you're getting into, special relativity, if you could take a course on that, there are online stuff you can do, then you can really get an idea of how very interesting, relatively simple math leads to incredible consequences.
Okay.
Okay.
So I got my Roku box, my little Roku device. For Amazon Prime.
Oh, that reminds me. Amazon Anonymous.
Oh, we almost forgot. Yes, I got my... Oh, and yes, my Amazon purchases were not credited.
I told you.
So I'm going to have to use Basic Brewing for my personal...
For some reason, because we have... We tried to put our stuff on Amazon, but they recognize that we've accessed it or some. I don't know what they recognize.
I don't know because I always so for a while, and it did work. Is I would purchase my Amazon stuff through a Chrome incognito window.
That's not good enough through
my other account, because my affiliate's account is through a different email address than my personal account, and it did work. But I just bought bike tires and this laser gun and a Roku box and a few other things, and none of it got credited.
Mm-hmm.
So they know. They know. They figured me out. So now I'm going to have to use Basic Brewing's radios. None of you do this because you need to use Craft Beer Radio's affiliate link. But because I can't use my own link, Grig and I are going to use James's link. So if you're conflicted about using James's link instead of our link, you can use our link, and we'll use James's link.
Yeah.
And then everyone gets paid. We all get real paid.
Believe me, we buy stuff, so yeah. So it'll go to Basic Brewing or whatever I decide to go to. There is some interesting stuff here. Why don't we pause it and let you search for something?
Sounds good. Okay, Amazon Anonymous. What do you got, Greg?
So I have two things, if you don't mind.
I don't mind, because okay. I've cheated before.
All right. So my number one thing is someone bought relighting birthday candles, which I thought
assholes. You're an asshole.
Why?
Buying relighting birthday candles?
I just think they're funny.
What a dick.
They got magnesium in their wicks, so they relight. They're not always perfect. which I love about them, because sometimes you can blow them out and they don't do anything. So they're kind of funny, but and also when you light them, they spark clearly because they have magnesium in them. So you clearly know these are not your standard birthday candles. So you know, don't be worried about these are the special ones. You know, you can tell. But I thought that was funny that someone bought them only $1.82. But the other thing that I thought was really cool is somebody bought the Pokemon Child's Deluxe Pikachu costume. Nice. Some kids going as Pikachu. Pikachu rules. So yeah, I guess. And I never really played the Pokemon thing, but I know Pikachu is like the coolest Pokemon.
All right, so I got two as well. I picked the slingshot, but really, the Wall Coaster Extreme Stunt Set, $21.99. So this thing looks like it's a marble game type thing that you stick to the wall, uh-huh. and they kind of build like a marble track on your wall.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
You drop it and it kind of goes around and stuff. That looks awesome! Extreme Jump Course with marbles. And, let's see. So let's look at the... Oh, warning, choking hazard. Toy contains a marble. Do not use for children under 3 years. Choking hazard. This toy has a marble. Choking hazard. Small parts. Not for children under 3 years. It actually says that 3 times on the page.
Huh.
So I think there might be a choking hazard, but the...
Just a guess. Did you also look at the Marble Mania Accelerator 2.0?
No, I didn't see that one.
That's down in the very bottom of Toys and Games.
Oh, it's right above the one I actually paid attention to.
Lots of marbles.
Warning, choking hazard.
Warning.
Awesome. Okay. So I got my Roku box mm-hmm. from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
No referral link because they figured me out.
Mm-hmm.
I got the one that's like $79, I think. It has the remote control has an earphone port, so you can plug your earphones into the remote and then listen to it, and the TV goes mute, so you don't wake up your wife when she's sleeping. It's pretty cool. And we have Amazon Prime, so the main reason I got it was to watch the Prime videos on the TV upstairs. Kids love it. Dirty mm-hmm. Jobs. You know, you came over a couple nights where we're watching Dirty Jobs one.
Yep.
And they came over. Max loves Dirty Jobs. Allie likes it too. Lots of other great apps. The Roku Box is pretty cool. I was watching The Universe, you know, from Discovery.
Oh, that
show. No, The Universe? Yeah, The Universe.
It was, yeah, yeah.
It's the one on.
The first one or two seasons were great, and then they turned into shit.
Well, I was watching the one on Comets. And it was...
Okay, that's probably not... They fair, don't go crazy
yeah,
nonsense.
No, that. I mean, it was okay, but it wasn't great. But it was introduced to me, the scattered disk. Have you heard about the scattered disk?
The scattered disk.
Yeah, it's a region between the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud. And it's the Kuiper Belt... I'm sorry, I said Kuiper Belt. I mean, the Kuiper Belt... it's kind of on the ecliptic where the scattered right. disk...
Well, not really. The Kuiper Belt is still inclined off the ecliptic.
It well, the like scattered
Pluto.
Disk is...
Pluto is inclined yeah, 20...
The scattered disk is more inclined, and it's more elliptical, where it like goes from 30 AU to 150 AU. Mm-hmm. You know, the orbits and those things, you know, very, very...
And the Oort Cloud is like, what, 800 AU?
Well, the Oort Cloud is almost spherical around the solar
yeah,
system.
Yeah. Well,
if not, it's Taurus.
It's theorized, right. But let's make that clear. The Oort Cloud has not been proven.
Yeah, but it's kind of this intermediary, and a lot of the short period comets come from the scattered disk. It was interesting. I never heard about scattered disk, so I went on Wikipedia, I started reading about it and stuff, and how it relates to the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud and whatnot. So, something worth looking into for your deep space. Knowledge.
Hmm.
It doesn't seem like it's bullshit. It seems like it's a real thing.
Hmm.
And so it overlaps the Kuiper Belt, goes much further than the Kuiper Belt. It doesn't, it barely reaches the closest theorized parts of the Oort Cloud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's like 5 items that have been observed that they theorize are in the Oort Cloud. Only 5?
Yeah.
Out of the trillions?
Well, I mean, that's going to make sense because the Oort Cloud is so far away that anything that comes near us is going to be it's going to be gone for so long. It's mm-hmm. going to be millions upon millions of years, which is much longer than human civilization is going to last. So.
Yeah. Neat stuff. So, yeah, either check out the Universe's Comets one or just check out the Scattered Disc and just follow a bunch of links on Wikipedia, you know, to and from that
Remember, gravity falls out by the square of the distance, but it never fully goes away. And so that's why you have these things out there that are just very weakly interacting with gravity. Just occasionally they'll get pushed in, and then they'll get thrown into the solar system at an extraordinarily hyperbolic trajectory, and then come right back out and fling away and possibly come around again, but maybe not.
No, most of them are gone forever. It's neat stuff. I mean, it hurts your head to think about the scale of these things. You go on Wikipedia and you see the scale of the inner solar system, the outer solar system, the Kuiper Belt, the scattered disk, the Oort cloud. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't even see the outer solar system barely in the Oort cloud diagram. It's just so small. So much bigger. It's nuts. Scale just hurts your head.
It gives you an idea of why there is such a weird why there's this hierarchy problem, why there is this. We're so used to things close together, condensed matter, this kind of stuff, this electromagnetic interaction, and then there's this gravitational interaction, which is nothing where we are. I mean, you know, it's powerful in the sense that we travel around the sun, but we don't really notice.
You got this thing that's like several thousand astronomical units away. So the distance from the Earth to the sun is 1 AU. So 2,000 AUs, and this thing's so far out there, it's like, no, you can't even see it. It can't even see the sun practically. And Jupiter can perturb it and cause it to fly into the solar system. It can't even see the solar system practically. You know, it's insane.
Well, it can't. Yeah,
it can. It can see that there's a star there, but it looks almost like any other star. Yeah. You know, it's so far away. And just Jupiter floating around perturbs this comet to say, hey, I'm going to fly in here. It boggles.
There's probably other stuff that goes on. There's probably other dynamics.
Well, I mean,
at that point,
at that point, the gravitational pull of Proxima Centauri, right, comes into play with these things in the Oort cloud too. At 4 light years away, can perturb these things. So,
yeah.
I was reading up about this stuff. You know, Nemesis, right? The brown dwarf thing has been pretty much discounted by all real scientists.
Yes.
But there's another one. I can't remember the name.
Nibiru, that one?
What was it?
Nibiru?
I don't know, but there's another theorized thing out there in the scattered disk or something like that.
I think you're thinking of Nibiru.
And, you know, it seems a little more, the way Wikipedia wrote it, it sounded a little more plausible than Nemesis, but yeah, until you have observation, who cares, right? Or until the math says it's there. But the math doesn't really... Math says, oh, this is one out of 10,000 possibilities. You know, that's what the math says now. Not good enough, right?
No.
So, it's just like...
Remember what we require for discovery, 5 sigma. It's 99.9999%.
Right.
That it's true.
Yeah, I'm like, I never heard of it.
1 in 10,000 is a lot different.
There's another big, monstrous, evil thing floating around outside the solar system you can't see.
As far as we can tell, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's plenty of other monstrous things going on.
Well, like, Nemesis was a theorized thing. Like, every 26 million years, there was a mass extinction on Earth. Mm-hmm. Why? Because comets are flying in. Why do comets start flying in? Because there's this brown dwarf floating around out there that perturbs the comets. But they've done the research, and there's not mass extinctions every 26 million years.
Well, not only that, but we'd be able to see if there was an effect of some sort of brown dwarf out there. We would be able to measure that. Because, I mean, we can measure things that definitely wouldn't be able to. Like, we can measure the influence of dark matter. And dark matter is a wonderfully insane topic. But the amazing thing about it is that there's something going on. There's something that's causing it so that galaxies all rotate at the same rate, whereas you'd think the stuff in the inside would rotate faster than the stuff on the outside, but they're all rotating at the same rate.
Wait, why do you say that?
That's
would expect the stuff to be on the outside going faster because it's has further distance. It's radial velocity at that point.
Well, no, you're talking about the stuff on the inside, just like a record, right?
The stuff on the outside goes faster, radially, than the inside. You're backwards.
What? The inside goes faster compared to the outside, because the outside is moving...
No, wrong. You're backwards. There's more distance cover one rotation on the outside of a record has to cover like a foot and a half. Mm-hmm. On the inside record, it covers like 9 inches. So it has to go faster to cover that speed in the same amount of time. It's rotational velocity.
Right, right.
The further you're out in the circle, the faster you're going. That's why helicopter blades can only go so fast, or can only be so big, because otherwise they start breaking the speed of sound and causing all kinds of shockwaves and stuff on the outside.
Okay, yeah. I'm looking at it a slightly different way. I mean, you're right, but the point is that in a galaxy, in every galaxy we measured, from the outside to the inside, they're all moving at the same speed. So
I don't have any knowledge of
so that. So that's where, I mean, we talked about LCDM before, right?
Well, explain to those stupid people what LCDM is.
It's not stupid people, it's just people who don't necessarily follow this sort of stuff. But LCDM is a lambda cold dark model, lambda cold dark matter model of Big Bang cosmology.
Oh, absolutely. Okay.
Right? So lambda being the cosmological constant and cold dark matter being the other aspect that explains galactic rotation and other things in terms of, you know, how things stick together when we see more mass than we can see through things that are lit up, mm-hmm. basically. And the whole idea behind the CDM, the cold dark matter point, is that it's kind of this, boy, it's so hard to get into what it is without, you know, oversimplifying it, but oversimplifying it actually helps for people to understand it. It's kind of this goo. It's kind of this goo that is around, that kind of sticks to the other stuff that's in the galaxy. And the reason why we think it works like that, and why we call it cold dark matter. Cold is very important. Cold means it's not moving very fast. It's not moving at relativistic speeds. It's dark matter, and we think it's non-baryonic because we don't think it's made of the same stuff that we are made of. We think it's collisionless because the idea here is that if it were electromagnetically bound in some way, then we would see it interact mm-hmm. with things. But it doesn't. It doesn't seem to interact with itself except for gravitationally. So it's cold, it's collisionless, it's non-relativistic. So we see this kind of goo around everything that sort of slows things down because it's gravitationally interacting with stuff. But it's not doing anything else besides that. It's not interacting with itself in any major way, and it's not interacting with the stuff that's around us. And so that's why we think it's weakly interacting, because that would be the only thing that really makes sense in terms of the standard model. If for it to not be in some way, for not to have some either weak isospin or hypercharge, then it wouldn't really make sense in terms of the standard model. So we think it's weakly interacting, which is why we think we can detect it through weak measures. But because they're weak, they're really hard to detect mm-hmm. and to, you know, differentiate from the background. But it's so far been undetectable, so we don't know what it is. But it makes sense based on the theory that that's what it is. It's this it's this particle. Really, and remember, particles are fields. So particles and fields are interaction. So really what it is there's this field, there's this other field out there. And in some areas, it has very low energy or no energy, and at some levels, it has very high energy. And where it has high energy, it's acting as kind of a goo that other stuff is sort of attracted to and slowed down by because it has gravitational influence. So that's the cold dark matter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sounds good. I was following you for most of that.
Cool. I'm glad.
Beer and physics.
Good stuff. That's my favorite combination. There was one thing that I want to talk about, which is that we were in Denver, and like I said, we were not able to get Jeff high. We're going to be very tinily high because somebody was walking around. I think this was on Friday. Yeah. We were walking out of there, and you were like, "It smells like marijuana." I'm like, "Yes, it smells good." And somebody said, "Here." And passed along a joint to me, and I smoked a hit off of this joint. A hit. And Jeff was like, are you going to be okay to drive? This, remember, this is after.
I didn't say that.
Yes, you did. This was after.
I wasn't talking about the weed if I was asked, if I asked that question.
Okay. Well, it felt like you're talking about the weed because I was like, it was after over an hour of me just drinking water and nothing else. And Jeff was like, are you going to be okay to drive?
No,
like,
I would have never asked that question.
Okay.
About one puff of.
Okay.
A joint from one guy in the street.
I want to make sure.
Unless, like, you were, like, telling me, I was like, oh, I feel like I'm laced with PCP.
No.
Then I would have asked it.
Okay. No. Because my explanation was like, no, it's like, you know, if you had nothing to drink all day and someone gave you a shot of Jägermeister, that's essentially what one puff of a joint is like. Barely it'll impact you. I mean, if you had eight puffs, you're in a different situation.
Right.
But if you had one thing, it's not going to hurt.
I'm almost positive I wouldn't have. I'm not, you know, I haven't watched the, what are those propaganda movies? The marijuana,
Reefer Madness.
Right? Yeah. I wasn't thinking like it was like Reefer Madness.
I wanted to make sure. But no, it, you know, it was, I think I did a very good job driving.
Yeah, I mean, it was a while. We went to the food truck and had some banh mi, and you had a dinner of some sort.
Right, something. It was much more than banh mi.
Wonderfully spiced.
Oh, it was good.
Oh, so good
stuff. Those food trucks were so great.
And the host, the lady, the owner, presumably, was so kind, you know, so friendly, like, talking to you, like... And I must have a doppelganger in Denver because there's like three times this weekend, like people thought I looked familiar, like they knew me or something like that. So there's a doppelganger of Jeff Bear in Denver.
If you meet Jeff Bear, it might not be. I did want to talk about this craft beer versus home brewer thing.
Okay.
Because we talked about the machine, the
Zymatic.
Zymatic. And there was some talk on a beer advocate forum post whether that qualified somebody as craft beer or not, and then there was talk on some of our Twitter stuff where we had a conversation about it, and you know, my complaint was the idea that, wait a minute, isn't a home brewer a meaningless distinction? And somebody then asked, let me get the name of it, the person who asked that question. But it was pause for dramatic effect. It was Sean Dombrowski, who said, you know, maybe this argument is best filed alongside craft versus crafty. Is craft beer a meaningless distinction?
Well, I mean, the post on the Beer Advocate forum that really made the most thoughtful or thing that made you think about it, like, is like, what if you take the formula of last year's gold medal winner for double IPA or something like that, right? You plug it into your Zymatic and it just makes it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, everyone enters the same beer, you know, and try, you know, and does that thing. Like, are those home brewers? Now, it would be more valid if this machine did everything from raw ingredients to packaging.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do the packaging. It makes wort,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to ferment the wort.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the machine's the brewer, and you're the cellarman, right?
Essentially, it's a more advanced version of your automatic brewery.
It has a lot more controls, right?
It has a lot more controls, and you know, the ability to do, you know, some sort of stuff. But it's just a more advanced version.
But where do you draw the line, right? I mean, that's the
thing.
Where do you draw the line? And this isn't a replicator. This doesn't give you beer, you know, without effort. It gives you the wort, and you have to ferment the wort.
You have to pitch it. You have to...
And then you have to bottle the wort.
Bottle it,
and if you bottle the wort and oxidize the hell out of it, you're not going to win awards in a homebrew competition,
right.
You know? So it's not a set it and forget it as far as finished product. It's a set it and forget it as far as the brewing process.
Right.
It gives you impeccable control.
Now, what I saw is a lot of people in the thread saying, you know, I like to have my... Essentially, this is, you know, essentially what the basic argument against it was, is I like to have my hands in the process, which is fine. No, I totally understand that. But then to discredit anybody who does this.
Well, it's just like your Goethe mount right there, yeah. Right? I mean, it's very. So astronomy. Greg has a telescope sitting right behind him with a Goethe mount.
Mm-hmm.
You aim it at some stars. It figures out what stars those were. And then you say, I want to go see Neptune. And it points you at Neptune. And you don't have to find Neptune. And you can look at Neptune's bad example because you can't see Neptune with the 5.4
yeah.
inch telescope, or 5.25 inch telescope. But you can see Uranus. We saw Uranus with mm-hmm. it. And we would have never seen Uranus without the Goethe mount. If we were using the 3.5, we would never pointed the thing yeah. in the right place.
Right.
I'm torn on that one even, right? Because I like the idea of finding the stars, pointing in the right place of the sky. You know, there's a certain feel of accomplishment, like, oh, I found it. Holy shit, I can't believe I found it. Where with the Goethe mount, you don't get that part. But you do get the, oh, wow, that's really awesome. I can see Uranus.
Right.
And we would have never found Uranus with the manual telescope.
Not only is it the accomplishment, but also the nice thing about the Goethe mount is once you find something and you have your thing on it, you don't have to keep adjusting.
Well, you can buy a stepper motor for the equatorial mount and it does that too.
Yeah, but at that point, you're paying the same amount of price.
You are, but you still have more skills.
Yeah, but my point is simply that it's not just the very basics of finding something. There's also other things that come along with the Goethe mount that give it extra, you know, extra value.
You're definitely on the Goethe mount side. I'm leaning towards the thrill of finding something on your own. Like when I was using the manual scope and found certain nebulas or galaxies, or there was a thrill of, yes, I found it. I found these guide stars and I walked it in from there. You know, I personally like that aspect of it. I'm not poo-pooing the Goethe mount because I've seen things through that telescope I would have never seen through a manual scope.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much like this whole homebrewing. Do you... You have a recipe, you enter it into the machine, it manages your mash and your boil.
I think the point is you don't poo-poo either way, right? Don't poo-poo yeah. the zymatic simply because it makes a wort for you. That's just it's just accomplishing something, you know, different. Now you may feel better about doing it on your own in your own mash tun, et cetera, but you're just removing one of the several steps.
Oh, so there's another issue with the zymatic, which I would really like to see more data on. They don't boil their right. wort. They keep it at 208 degrees. And for the product, it makes sense. Because when you have this under-the-shelf automatic beer maker, all that boiling vaporization is problematic. You don't want to have it in the kitchen. You don't want to have to mm-hmm. deal with venting it, things like that. So they don't boil. They have a electric heating element, much like I have, and a recirculation system. And they keep recirculating this wort, so the whole wort stays at 208 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
They claim that this does what is necessary to make beer.
I don't see why that's a problem. They, I mean, 208 versus 212 is a 4-degree difference. You're not going to get much higher than 212 because of the way the water turns heat.
From what every home brewer has been taught since day one, and every brewer has been taught since day one, is the boiling process is very important in boiling off volatile compounds.
Like DMS.
DMS, things like that. Right.
Is that necessarily true?
Well, that's the question.
That's the question.
It is almost literally written in stone that it's almost non-negotiable that boiling is a necessary step.
If it's found to be false, then you change your views.
Right, but you have one person saying you don't have to boil, and you know, hundreds or thousands of people saying you do.
What
have
is to, this?
It's a bracelet that holds quarters.
Why would you need it?
I don't know. I'm not sure where it came from, but it's here.
Okay.
Like Sorry. Much of the stuff in my house, married with children. Not everything in this house is mine.
Okay. Well, anyway, I mean, like, you know, I understand.
It requires more research.
Yeah, it requires more research, but if it's shown to be true,
it's a groundbreaking and implausible development if this makes indistinguishable beer from boiled beer.
Mm-hmm.
From everyone in the industry that everything I know, this should not make the same quality beer as boiled beer.
Mm-hmm.
If it does, it is a groundbreaking revolution.
Well, there you go.
It's an amazing claim that requires amazing evidence.
Yes.
Right? So, that's what it is.
Yes. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So, yeah. No, I would say that it deserves testing because it... Jeff is playing with the condom. Which has lost a lot of its...
It didn't hold the air very well.
So it might be kind of, full of holes.
I think it was the knot at the end because you didn't pull the hole.
No, I didn't pull the hole away, so through, so that's probably the issue. I think that while I agree with you to a point, I don't see the scientific evidence to assume that boiling is necessary to pull off DMS. I don't see a huge reason why boiling is necessary to boil off the DMS versus just heating to break it down.
But there's no exfiltration of material in a closed system where it's just heating it up.
I'm just saying heating can break it down.
Break it down. It needs to vaporize and go away.
Why do you say that?
Because that's what I've been trained to say.
Well, exactly. I mean, what I'm saying.
Because
I trust
that many very smart brewers have tested this.
Volatizing only and not being destroyed by heat.
It needs more. I don't have the argument. I'm just saying the standard knowledge is you have to boil because of several reasons. Boiling does protein breaks. It does vaporization of the DMS and other compounds. And when you have it in a closed system where there is no exfiltration of gases or anything like that, those compounds can't leave the beer. And you would think it would be a horribly sulfury mess if they don't do the boil. Now, if they have, it is truly a breakthrough if their claims are substantiated.
Is it a breakthrough or is it just I guess it is sort of a breakthrough.
It's a breakthrough in the brewing science. It's a breakthrough in brewing science. If their claims, if you can brew two beers, one boiled, one not, and do a triangle test and not distinguish which one was the not boiled, then it's a breakthrough.
So I don't think their claims deserve to be immediately, their claims deserve to be held with scrutiny, as all claims do. But they don't deserve to be immediately dismissed without testing. I don't think that there is enough reason to immediately dismiss without testing. So I would like to test. But I do agree that there is...
I think their method can make some beers good. I don't think it can make all beers good.
That may be true. But that may not necessarily be the point of the machine. The machine is not to...
Their campaign pretty much says you can make everything awesome.
Yeah. On the other hand, I've seen stuff like how to use Mr. Brewer. What is it?
Mr. Beer.
Mr. Beer to make really interesting beers, mm-hmm. even though people would not necessarily use Mr. Beer as their primary version of a beer thing. So in the same sense, maybe people could find ways to turn this machine into a real interesting brew machine.
But back to your initial question, whether someone using a Zymatic is really a home brewer.
Right.
If the thing fermented and packaged the beer, I would be leaning much more towards no, they're not a home brewer. But it doesn't ferment and package the mm-hmm. beer. You ferment and package the beer, and you can really fuck shit up
mm-hmm.
if you don't ferment and package the beer right.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally, while I'm not sure about this boiling thing, not boiling thing, I am leaning towards you're still a home brewer if you're using the Zymatic. You're a rich, frivolous home brewer, but you're still a home brewer.
you're using something to skip a couple steps. To make a couple steps automated.
Okay. Malt extract.
Yeah,
right. Does the same thing.
Yes, absolutely.
You're buying something that's already mashed and then condensed. You know, so you know, it playing pro. Yeah,
lots of the comments I saw, I was just rolling my eyes because, like, no, I would never do that. Now, I would never consider any beer.
Use more of the comic book guy.
I would never do that. That's not the kind of beer that I would make. I make it on my shelf. So it was, you know, I would never consider it. I would never even let that approach my material. That's not how it works. Yeah, to me that's a awful way to look at things. I think it's a meaningless distinction, especially since we got, you know, like we said, we got to the point where you're making your own wort. You're just using a machine to do it, to do some of the steps, as opposed to manually controlling the amount of propane that goes into. You know, it's silly. You know, you're still composing your own recipes or using other recipes that you got. You're still
So I mean, it's an expensive device.
Yes, $1,300,
and it makes 3 gallon batches.
Right.
That is a big expense that has
for a small amount of beer.
Very small market, I think. I think their best market is as a prototype system for small breweries.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because if you can just throw some things in there, see how it works, pour it out, because you know a home brewer, well, they make 5 gallons of stuff, and you know, or a quote unquote home brewer in the old sense, they make 5 gallons of stuff and they hold it and they have it, and if it's crap, it's crap. But with this, you're paying $1,300 for the initial machine just to be able to make stuff, make wort that you can then use. And if it's crap, you throw it out, you make some more stuff. And it's not that hard on you.
No, the market is diminished by lots of breweries. So, bigger breweries, they don't do small prototype batches. The brewer knows how to formulate a beer. You know, they
We talked about Sam Adams, and they do 10-gallon batches.
They do. It's changing. Yeah. But more historically, you know, I've talked to places that new beer... 500 barrels, you know, so the brewer has to formulate something that's going to, you know, not going to suck, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the old school way of doing it, but there are more and more breweries that have, you know, homebrew systems on site to prototype things. But, you know, maybe that's doing more non-traditional things, right? Like, oh, brewery wants to start a new pale ale. Pretty easy to spec out a pale ale. So brewery wants to do a new hibiscus and honey buckwheat sour Berliner Weiss. You know, you might want to spec that. You might want to test that out.
That's going to be a little bit harder for you to do.
Right. So, what do you say?
Well, I say that we are one out away from having our World Series known because Boston is winning 5-2 in the ninth.
Okay.
The St. Louis has already won the NLCS.
Fucking Cardinals. Not like they care.
Just because they lost, the Pirates lost. Hey, the Pirates got a lot further than they have in 18 years. So give them a break. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Game over. It's going to be Boston versus the Cardinals. Boston versus St. Louis.
Exciting. Penguins are 9-1.
Well, they still have 80 games to play, right?
No, they have 70 games to play.
Okay.
74.
All right.
But they're 9-1. Tearing it up. Go Pens.
Good night, everybody.